It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our discussion now with Peter Connors. His new book is Jamerica, on the history of jam bands and the festival scene. Starting with the Grateful Dead, bands like Phish, and a whole bunch of others, and festivals that have sprung up around the country. Hoping to hear from you at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of jam bands? Have you gone to see some shows? Did you follow any of them for a while? Do you trade bootlegs in person or online? 800-642-1234. Send an email to talk@wpr.org or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Peter on Facebook, August writes, top in my memories are my very first concert at age 13, the Grateful Dead in Chicago, and hitchhiking across the country, seeing Phish, Further, Modesky Martin and Wood, and others along the way. Now my favorite thing is seeing my little hippies, age 2, 4, and 5, getting into jam grass. Wow, a lot to unpack there. First of all, multi-generational. Do you see a lot of parents handing this on to their kids and passing on the tradition?
Absolutely, and that's one of the fun things to see at the festivals in particular. As you see, honestly, at this point, you could see three generations. You know, you could see grandparents who maybe grew up through the 60s, and then they've had children, and then they bring their children. So I have seen three generations, and they're always quite proud to be there together and to be sharing that experience as well. So, that's not uncommon.
And jamgrass is a phrase he uses. That's a thing?
Yeah, well, that's sort of, the jam scene loves its hyphens, you know, to help describe its music. And so jamgrass is a mix between bluegrass and jam. And, you know, there's all sorts of bands. Colorado seems to be quite a hotbed for jamgrass. And, you know, there's bands like String Cheese Incident, Leftover Salmon. There's a whole slew of bands that have come even after them that could be sort of fit into that jamgrass label.
Let's give a listen to String Cheese Incident. You just mentioned them. Here it is. One of their slower bits. I think they're usually a bit more up-tempo than that particular track. But String Cheese Incident, I think I've heard jokes that you can't go anywhere in a lot of parts of the country without seeing a String Cheese Incident flyer somewhere nearby. They're kind of all over the place.
Yeah, and you know, it's amazing the travel that all these bands put in. I mean, they are truly road warriors. And, you know, some of that, again, going back to the Grateful Dead model, is that's the way that they have to operate within the business as well, because, you know, most of them don't sell many albums at all. You know, they're not getting radio airplay support, but what they do and what they love to do is play live. And so most of these bands are on the road, you know, just an immense number of days per year, playing all over the country, often playing with each other, too, and sharing venues and sharing bills. So, you know, again, it's a neat way that the music connects people across the country as well. And if you're a fan who loves to travel, it gives these fans a chance to see different parts of the country and experience their favorite band as well.
Let's give a listen to another band, Spin Doctors. I guess I am not super familiar with the definition of jam band. I don't know if I would have thought they'd be there, but let's give a listen, then you can talk about them a little. I think that's one of their hit singles there, Two Princes. How did Spin Doctors make the cut? Did they latch on to the festival scene?
Well, I think they were just in it really early on, and they came out of the New York City scene, and specifically a club called the Wetlands in New York City that was really ground zero for the emergence of the jam band scene. Bands from all over the country, you know, including Phish and all these different bands, went through Wetlands at one time or another in the early to mid-90s and played there. And because Spin Doctors was from New York City, they were one of, you know, the sort of house bands for the Wetlands. They were one of the first bands playing on the Horde tour. So there was more right time, right place than the particular style of music that they played. And Chris Barron is interviewed quite extensively in the book. They're a much more song-oriented band than jam-oriented. But again, they were part of the community because they were, you know, there at just the right time, and they helped kick off the whole scene.
And August on Facebook mentioned Modesky Martin and Wood. I think you mentioned Bella Fleck and the Flecktones. Again, those sound like ones that might be not what you'd think of when you think of Grateful Dead and Fish and the other bands we're talking about. Have they also been natural fits with the festivals that people are going to?
Yeah, they have been, and those are both, you know, they have a lot more jazz in their music, especially Modesky, Martin, and Wood. And Bella Fleck has gone off into some really interesting explorations of world music as well. But yeah, those are both, you know, they're more jazz-oriented, but again, they're great improvisers, and they love to take off from a song, and they're musically, they're incredible. They have wonderful chops, and they're just very talented musicians. So they can take off from the song and go into these wonderful improvisations, and that's really why they are part of the scene.
It seems like it would be natural for people who like jam bands and all the improvisation to get into full-on jazz, because, I mean, that's a huge part of what that kind of music is. Do you see a lot of crossover in that way?
I think crossover as long as it has some rock in it.
Okay.
You know, you don't really see straight jazz musicians showing up at the festivals, but you certainly see a lot of homage paid to jazz musicians and a jazz inflection in a lot of the music. So I think it's more of a reverence and a learning that has taken place from interacting with jazz than having straight jazz musicians come in to the jam scene. And that said, there's a couple players right now playing with Bob Weir and Phil Lesh from Further. Joe Russo is one of them, the drummer for this band called Further now that the Grateful Dead has sort of spun off into, who comes right from the jazz background. So, you know, there is that there definitely strongly, but again, you don't necessarily see straight jazz musicians showing up.
What are the big festivals now that the bands we've been talking about are showing up at and the fans are going to, hoping to see their favorites and maybe learn some new ones?
Well, Bonnaroo has certainly become, you know, just a huge sort of a monster of a festival. But that one really started out also as a jam band festival. And, of course, now it's evolved to have, you know, hip-hop acts, or I think Radiohead has played there, all sorts of huge, you know, bands. But Bonnaroo did start as a jam band festival. And you have Mountain Jam in Hunter, New York. There's Gathering of the Vibes is a wonderful festival. You know, there's honestly so many festivals in every region of the country. Going around, you know, going on all year round, that it's quite staggering.
What's your favorite band to catch a show of nowadays?
Well, growing up as a Deadhead, you know, the Dead will always be my sort of touchstone band, and I listen to all sorts of different music, but at the end of the day, I always come back to the Grateful Dead. So for me, it's really fun to go and see the band Further that I had just mentioned play live, because it's two of the remaining members of the Grateful Dead. And they play all sorts of Grateful Dead songs that the band didn't actually play while I was going to see them and while Jerry Garcia was alive. So I always have the most fun at those shows, personally.
Let's take a call. We've got Heather on the line in La Crosse. Heather, hi.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good. So are you a fan of the bands we're talking about?
Yeah, I am. I haven't ever been to a Fish show or any of those other bands, but there's actually a festival going on this weekend that all my friends are at. In Minnesota. That's really fun.
What's the festival?
It's called Shangri-La.
Okay. And any bands in particular that you'd be excited to see there?
Well, the band that puts it on is called Bookie Flip, and they're kind of a big group of people. I was just wondering if he had ever heard of them before.
I have heard of Wookie Foot. I've never seen them live, but I have heard of them.
Okay. And are there a lot of regional jam bands that maybe haven't quite broken through to the national audience yet, Peter?
You know, there are. And there are always, you know, it's just a constant evolution and a turning over. And I think, you know, one of the great things about these festivals is because a lot of times they'll start, let's say, at, you know, 12 noon, and the headliner won't come on until 9 or 10 at night. There's slots available for all these different bands that are emerging onto the scene to play, you know, in the early afternoon or what have you, to thousands of people who otherwise wouldn't know who these bands are, and sort of work their way up the ladder to these later and later time slots. So I'm always discovering new bands.
Well, Peter, if this sounds like an alien world to people listening now, can you give a quick pep talk to wrap up, to maybe go out or go online at least to check out a live track?
Don't fear the jam. Enjoy it. Just relax into it, and it'll take you very, very interesting musical places. Enjoy it.
Peter, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
That's Peter Connors, author of Jamerica, the history of the American jam, or history of the jam band and festival scene. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Preliminary data from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention shows that our nation's fertility rate has stabilized for the first time in 5 years. It had been falling to the lowest levels on record.
Now that that fertility rate is starting to level off, it has some people wondering, does this mean the American family is starting to bounce back from the recession?
Well, what do you think? Do you think we're finally rebounding from the recession? And how was your family affected? Did you decide to maybe delay having children or getting married because of the tough economic times? You can give us a call and let us know what you're thinking at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Kathleen Gerson joins us now. She's a professor of sociology and collegiate professor of arts and science at New York University and the author of The Unfinished Revolution, Coming of Age in a New Era of Gender, Work, and Family. Kathleen, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, nice to be with you.
Well, tell us a little bit about what the data is showing about fertility rates in America.
Well, I think the first thing to say is that any one piece of data, you don't want to jump to too many conclusions about it. Taken alone, it's somewhat limited, but if you step back and you put it in perspective, I think it says a variety of things, not all of which fit together very well. It does appear that in the short run, the U.S. is coming back to the kinds of fertility rates that we are used to seeing, although I would also add that that rate is below what we call the replacement rate, which is how many children a woman would have to have to replace the population at its current level, so which would be 2 children per woman. And even the birth rate as it is now, which has bounced back, still not up to that replacement rate yet. Nevertheless, I don't think we're in for some, we don't need to worry somehow that we're, that our population is endangered, that we're not reproducing enough citizens. So I think it's largely good news. The question, of course, is what does it mean? In what ways is it good news? And what other issues does it prompt us to think about?
Well, when we're talking fertility rate, we're talking about the number of babies born, basically, per year, right?
Right. Well, there's a difference between the birth rate and the fertility rate, and I don't want to get the terms mixed up. But the birth rate is how many children are born, whereas the fertility rate within a certain period. The fertility rate really is more likely to refer to how many children a woman of a certain generation can expect to have over her lifetime. So there is a slight difference there. If you think about it, the birth rate can go up and down in a way, whereas over the long run, it's probably the fertility rate that matters more.
So how can you predict how many children a woman will have when she hasn't made that choice yet?
Oh, you can't. And and I'm not a demographer myself, but I study a lot of demography. And I can tell you that it's always very dangerous to predict, especially if you're predicting that somehow the trends that are appearing today will continue into the future. That's a very dangerous way to go, which is exactly why I said I think we want to look at today's numbers as an encouraging sign, but not draw too many conclusions. I'll give you a good example of that, which was in the 1950s, when the baby boom was born, and most Americans have heard of that. Some of us are even part of that. I certainly am. If you had simply continued to predict that the birth rate would continue, you would have imagined that we would have gone on to have baby booms into the future. Well, it actually turned out to be a fairly temporary and short-lived phenomenon, exactly because the conditions of people's lives changed, and their decisions about whether or not to have children and when to have children also change. I think it sounds like a very dry term, but the way to think about it is those numbers come from all of those decisions made by all of us, the most momentous decisions we can make in our lives, whether or not to have a child, when to have a child, those are huge decisions to make. And when you aggregate them, it doesn't sound very interesting. But in fact, it represents some very important life choices and opportunities that we enjoy or don't enjoy.
Well, one interesting way to read the data is as proof of a rebound from the recession that we've been in. Mm-hmm. And everyone has, you know, a lot of people. It's hard to find someone who hasn't been touched in some way by mm-hmm. the recession. And one way that they've been affected is by delaying having that child, mm-hmm. broadening their family, maybe getting married. And this is do you see that as a hopeful sign that things are moving, trending in a different direction as far as the recession goes?
Well, I do think that it's probably reasonable to infer that this particular turnaround does reflect a rebounding of the economy. However, I also think you want to be careful not to take that too far. We do know that economic trends do affect people's decisions about the timing of birth, and it probably does suggest that more people are feeling more able to start families that they may have postponed. On the other hand, we also want to keep in mind that in some ways the recession was sort of an extreme version of other major changes which are happening in our society, and those are not going to go away. The rise of women in the workplace, the increasing pressures on families to juggle work with childcare and caretaking, the enormous expense of raising children. So while, yes, I do think it's good news, I don't think we should take that sort of too smugly, because we still need to face all of the challenges of how we help young people and new generations balance work and family, create families, and manage to support them and care for them over an extended period of time. And for that, it's not, yes, it's good that the economy is bouncing back, and it will be even better if it continues to be more stable. But in the long run, we're also going to have to face some more basic questions about creating child-supportive institutions and family-friendly workplaces.
So it's a multi-layered issue. And the fertility rate isn't just a woman's issue, but it does seem to say something about women of childbearing age in our society. Why do you think the rate had gotten mm-hmm. so low?
Well, that's a very interesting question. And I would also say, remember, a low is a relative term. The U.S. has never faced the kind of plummeting birth rates that some European countries have faced, such as Italy, Spain, or Russia. On the other hand, we've had a much harder time keeping our birth rates stable compared to other countries, especially countries like the Scandinavian countries. In the U.S., the interesting thing is that to a notable extent, our birth rates have remained more stable than many other countries, but it appears that it's primarily because we're a very welcoming society with a lot of immigration, and that has been able to offset some of the decline in the birth rate among native-born Americans. So
you're saying more immigrants to the country are having more children.
That does always tend to be the short-term effect. And then over time, as people assimilate, the new generations tend to have fewer. So it's been good. I think it's another way to think about the positive benefits of immigration, that we're constantly incorporating new people in our society that keep it going. So that's one thing that does distinguish us. On the other side of the ledger, what you see, the countries, the European countries that have been able to maintain a really stable birth rate just around the replacement rate, which is what most public policy people desire. And here's an irony, are those countries that have made it easier for mothers to work. The countries that have not provided supports for working mothers, ironically, are the ones that have had the most problems keeping their birth rates up.
So, right, so it's a function of more than any, the economy, as we're hearing
yeah.
right now. And we're talking, we're going to take a break and come back and talk further with Kathleen Gerson. She's a sociology professor at New York University. And we want to hear from you on this. How did you decide to delay having children or getting married because of the tough economic times? And what went into your decision making? Is it social policy, as we're hearing about? Is it age? What is it that's affected the size of your family? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234.
Yeah, it's interesting. Our guest said that this big data all comes down to decisions made by people like you. Call in at 800-642-1234. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. We're talking now with Kathleen Gerson, professor of sociology at New York University and the author of The Unfinished Revolution, Coming of Age in a New Era of Gender, Work, and Family.
I want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Here's the question for you. Did you decide to put off having kids or even getting married because of uncertainty about your personal economy, your job future, what was going to happen? Or did you make a tough decision to go ahead and try to work it out as best you could anyway? Or maybe you're putting off having another kid. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And if the economy wasn't your reason for postponing a family, why do you think there has been a trend of declining birth rates? Why did you decide maybe not to have children? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. And Kathleen, we have a comment here from Tim in Mauston who says, my wife and I are both in our mid-20s and are having our second child soon. I think my generation is just lazy. Broke or not, you can still have kids. It just takes more work. I don't know. Is there something to that?
Well, I think it's important to let people make the decisions that are right for them. So I certainly don't think that Tim's generation is lazy at all. One thing to keep in mind is that the good news is, unlike 100, 200 years ago, people do get to choose whether or not to have children, rather than it being a somewhat involuntary situation, one way or the other. People take that choice very seriously. Children are a lot of work, and it's important to know how much work they will be, in addition to how much of a commitment it will require, both in terms of earning a living and in caring for them before you do it. So I would say bravo for going ahead and having children. And I certainly agree that you shouldn't let anything stop you if that's what you really want to do. Human beings have been able to rear their children quite successfully throughout human history, and we don't necessarily need all the accoutrements that I think contemporary young people may feel is necessary. But it certainly is a responsible decision to make that choice based on the fact that you're ready for it and you want it, rather than it's something you just feel you should do.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Tim, for the comment. And next we go to Emily in Minocqua. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
Hi. What about your decision to have children?
I think I'm not alone in saying this, that if I were to choose to have children, it would be in an environment where I know they're going to have a secure upbringing. And I'm not one of those who had student loans, but I'm very conscientious about making sure I have a really solid foundation. I know a lot of people who have had children without that foundation, or they've been relying upon their partner and something goes wrong in their marriage. And I just want to make sure I personally have that as secure as I can before I even consider having children. So.
And a lot of people use similar reasoning. Thank you so much for that call, Emily. And that sounds like something a lot of people might say. What do you think, Kathleen?
Absolutely. I think that Emily touches on two really important aspects of this choice today. And the first is the increasing difficulty of establishing job security. the recession certainly brought that to people's minds, if it hadn't before. And even though people may be bouncing back, there's a big difference between having a job and knowing that you've got a secure financial future. And the new economy that we're in is making it harder to establish that sense, not just of having a job, but actually having a trajectory that you can see for being there in the future. And I think the second thing that Emily alludes to, which is also very important, is knowing that you're in a solid relationship that will be there in the future. And that's also increasingly more difficult to predict. And young people want to be very careful to make sure that they've been able to establish both parts of that equation.
All right. Thank you, Emily. And let's move next to Charlie in Milwaukee. Hey, Charlie.
Oh, hi. Great show. Love talking about something like this, too. I was going to say I'm a physician, and during my training, I had my whole life planned out, and we got married, and 9 months later had our first child. And in a lot of ways, I freaked out initially because I was going, my life is on a certain plan. I had everything regimented and planned. And, of course, with the new child, I had to change things. I used to get up at 4 in the morning to study.
Whoa.
And then stuff like that to get the time in so that I could still do my job, learn my trade, and still make things happen and try to keep the family happy and do what needed to be done. And although I didn't get to travel, although I didn't get to do things that I had planned, I wouldn't have traded any of it because my son has been just a joy to my life. And I think people a lot of times try to have everything planned, and yet life doesn't fit a set schedule, and we have to get over that. And I've seen with sick children, if you have a healthy child, you're the luckiest person in the world, and they bring so much joy. We need to get over ourselves, be less selfish, and live our lives to help others and help our children, because that's really what it's about.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that, Charlie. Appreciate that perspective from a physician who had to go a little bit off his charted path there. What would you say to Charlie, Kathleen?
Well, I completely understand and would agree that, I mean, the good news is that once we decide to have a child, whatever the reasoning is, and sometimes it's just closing your eyes and jumping in amid the uncertainty, and sometimes it's feeling more confident and comfortable that you're in a place where it's the right time for you. Whether it happens one way or the other, the good news is that virtually all of us are very happy once that creature is there. And yes, it changes our lives, but we are resilient. People are capable of adjusting and finding, there are always trade-offs, and finding the joy and the trade-offs that more than offset what you might have sacrificed.
All right. Well, Kathleen, we're going to leave it there, but I know you have to go. Thank you so much for sharing your insights with
pleasure.
Us today.
And good luck to everyone out there, whatever you decide to do.
All right. We're talking to Kathleen Gerson. She's a professor of sociology and collegiate professor of arts and science at New York University and the author of The Unfinished Revolution.
Now, as controversy over a proposed iron mine in northern Wisconsin continues, so do disputes over the mining industry's doings and history in northern Michigan. Chuck Kornbach has the first of two stories on mining in Michigan's Upper Peninsula and lessons for us here in the Badger State.
Two open-pit iron ore mines continue to dig deep into the earth near Marquette, Michigan. The Empire Mine has been in operation for a half century and now goes down more than 1,200 feet. From an observation plateau, huge ore-hauling trucks near the bottom of the mine look small and only create a small roar. $260 million of iron ore, worth well into the billions of dollars, have been trucked and shipped out of Empire. So when you ask spokesman Dale Hemela of the mine's owner, the Cliffs Corporation, to describe what he sees when he looks down into the pit, it isn't the trucks or the grays and reds of the exposed rock.
I see a lot of money that's gone from this area and brought money in. You know, what we do here is we take rocks and send it out of here and bring money back.
Himmler feistily rejects the idea that Empire and the nearby Tilden mine, also owned by Cliffs, are giant scars on the land.
Who made that argument? We've been employing people for generations. I'll give you an example. If you took Tilden, you took Empire, and you took everything that we do here, we impact about 20,000 acres of property here in Marquette County. For that 2% of the property in Marquette County, we've been employing people since the 1960s.
But Cliffs has had recent environmental problems in Marquette County, including unauthorized discharges of waste rock and the triggering of at least one fish consumption advisory. The company says that's not why it plans to close the Empire mine next year, claiming instead that one of its financial partners, a steel company, doesn't want to sink money into improvements. But there are no plans to shut down the 40-year-old Tilden mine, and Cliffs says it will keep running a huge ore processing facility. Inside that hot, dirty, and deafening building, giant machines rumble, rattle, and whistle. Occasionally, you can get close enough to Cliffs spokeswoman Jennifer Hittner to hear her, in this case, describing one of the machines called a de-slime thickener.
And these are the thickening tanks. What's happening here is your iron ore particles, which are heavier, sink to the bottom, and the waste material floats out over the top.
But the sound and sight of money being made is not how some people on the Upper Peninsula gauge the mining industry.
Right this way.
Kathleen Heidemann of Save the Wild UP leads a tour in the city of Negaunee, a few miles away from the Empire and Tilden mines, and very close to another mine shut down decades ago. Heidemann points to a building that's crumbling and sinking into ground that's been weakened by underground mining. She also talks about land closed off to the public and houses removed to protect public safety.
This is the sacrifice zone that mining companies talk about, a sacrifice zone. When they talk about mining, there's a certain sacrifice that comes along with mining. It's land or it's air quality or it's water quality. It's literally neighborhoods in this case.
The mining industry says it now does a much better job of reclaiming the land used for mining. But anti-mining activists in northern Michigan say opponents of the proposed GTAC iron ore mine in northern Wisconsin should stay buckled down and prepare to challenge pretty much all of the industry's promises. Chuck Quirnbach, Wisconsin Public Radio in the UP.
And thanks to Chuck for that report.
Next, we're talking to Wisconsin State Senator Glenn Grothman about a bill he's behind to change the way we define barbers in the Badger State.
This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. Here's something you might not know. In order to be licensed as a barber in Wisconsin, you have to be trained in dyeing and coloring hair.
That means even your corner barber with that blue and white whirling spiral out front should technically also be able to do your highlights.
State Senator Glenn Grothman of West Bend wants to change that requirement along with some other standards for barbers around the state.
And he's introduced a new bill that he says will create jobs.
Senator Grothman joins us now. Senator Grothman, welcome to the show for the first time.
Glad to be on the show. I always love talking to the erudite audience of Wisconsin Public Radio.
All right. That's kind of your catchphrase on the air here. Thanks.
Right.
Now, you've got this bill that would change barber licensing. Why does this change need to happen?
Well, I think if you notice, at least in my neck of the woods, and I have a feeling around the state, when you go to a barber, frequently you find a guy who's 55, 60, some of these guys in their 70s doing the barbering. And that's because over time, they've made it more and more difficult to become a barber. Until we passed a bill a year ago, the requirements for being a barber were in essence the same for being any sort of cosmetologist. And you have to know all the different things that a woman does to her hair, dyeing the hair, permanence, that sort of thing. And you have to learn all this stuff, but you don't need this stuff. But obviously, the quicker the training period, the more people you're going to have going into that profession. So we simplified things a little bit last time. We're going to simplify it a little bit further, and hopefully we'll go back to having more and more guys be able to find that corner barbershop that was so much a part of our history.
And so this is for people who want to just be barbers. They're using the
Absolutely.
Blade, the scissors, and maybe a razor every now and again.
Absolutely. That's the goal. You know, we're doing a variety of things. Not only are we saying that we take the requirements to know how to use various chemicals out of there, We're saying that you can go to school for more than 8 hours a day. Right now they won't let you go more than 8 hours a day, so you can wrap this stuff up. See if you can get trained in only 1,000 hours of time, which is good. So, you know, for people who want to whip things through here quickly or a non-traditional type student, it'd be a good thing to go into. We're also kind of reducing the amount of time to be an apprentice before you're a barber. We're trying to get it down to about 1,700 hours practical and about another 300 hours classroom. You know, I was a lawyer at one time. There's no apprentice required to being a barber.
Now, so, what did...
Go ahead.
Oh, and for people who do want to do the whole shebang and want to be able to do the perms and dyeing, would they still need that further training that everybody has to get now?
Oh, absolutely. You could have more training if you wanted to. If you wanted to be a full-blown cosmetologist, it's some more hours, but you'd still be able to do that. Absolutely.
Are there people out there where you're hearing from? I'd become a barber if I didn't have to spend all this time training to do the dyeing and all the other stuff?
Well, absolutely. This is stuff brought to us actually out of Milwaukee. There was a guy by the name of G. Smith who owns several barbershops in Milwaukee, and he brought it to our attention. He was having a shortage, having a hard time, as so many other employers were, of finding people to work as barbers in his shops. And, you know, I myself have sometimes had a hard time finding a barber. Things are all filled up. But we felt to help him out and to create more jobs, you know, particularly if there's a shortage of something, kind of at his suggestion, we began to simplify things, and we're simplifying a little bit more this year.
Now, how did we get to where we are now? Was it just we painted with too broad a brush and lumped people all in the same category?
Well, I think what happened is they got lumped together with a cosmetologist. The cosmetologist took over. There used to be a board for cosmetologists and barbers, and they kept that together. The cosmetologist kind of took it over. So in order to become a barber, you had to learn to do so much more than was necessary. And because you had to learn to do so much more than was necessary, people finally said, well, I'm not going to go through all this, and you wind up with a shortage of barbers.
Do you have a sense of how many jobs this might create?
Well, I can tell you, I don't know about yourself, I think society can certainly take more barbers. I don't have an exact amount, but, at a time when people are looking for work, and a time where there's a shortage of people doing something, we ought to solve the problem and get people out there. I'm sure I would be surprised if it wouldn't be more than 100 at least.
Any worries that we might have a glut of barbers if we make the barrier to entry too limited there?
No, I think we're far away from having a glut of barbers.
And
they're good barbers. Do you go to a barber?
I go to a barber two, three times a year.
Two or three times a year?
I keep my hair kind of long, yeah. I just get the occasional
trim. Oh, okay. I didn't know that. Okay, on public radio, that's what you get.
Yeah,
okay.
Well, radio in general, yeah.
Right. I try to go to a barber every couple of months, and quite frankly, I frequently, you know, when I need a haircut, I can't find anybody because they're all filled up. So I certainly sympathized when G. Smith there in Milwaukee couldn't get enough barbers because I can't find a barber all the time, and I think it's going to be a good thing for the state. And a barber shop is frequently was, a social center for people to meet. So it's not only that we need more barbers for cutting hair. I think more barbers is a good thing for socialization as well.
Do you get a sense, as you bring this up at the legislature, that other people are going to jump on board with you?
I hope they jump on board. You know, we sit there and say, A, we're for jobs, and B, we're for less government. If you combine a bill that means both more jobs and less government, there's something wrong if it doesn't go through the legislature.
Do you think there's you've argued against other regulations on some industries before? Is this, do you think, just a symptom of government wanting to regulate too much?
Yeah. I think it always happens. See, what happens in almost any profession is the type of people who get on these boards, they like to do something. And as we're everywhere else in government, do something means expand government. So, you know, they always say, oh, let's put a few more hours on here for training or require people to learn about this and that. The way it was brought to our attention in part was this cosmetology board, they were requiring barbers a couple of years ago to take a class every year. I mean, my goodness, you had guys who were barbers for 40 years. All of a sudden, they were required to take a class. They didn't need to learn anything, not to mention they had to take off a day of work, not earn money then, drive somewhere, pay somebody to teach them something they didn't know, didn't need to know. It was kind of ridiculous. So that's kind of how this thing bubbled up. When the old cosmetology board was telling these 65-year-old barbers, hey, you got to take a class every year. They were saying, what? What? I need a class? I've been doing this for 40 years without a class. So that was kind of what caused it to bubble to the top here.
So there would still be some kind of training requirement remaining for the barbers.
Absolutely. These guys got to take 1,000 hours training. And then they got to go through a 1,700-hour apprenticeship. And 1,700 hours is a lot. That's almost a whole working year. I mean, I think we are required to do an awful lot. Like I said, I used to be a lawyer. Maybe your listeners don't know this. You can graduate from law school, take the bar exam, never done anything in your life, throw up your shingle, and you're a lawyer without ever actually doing anything. So we're requiring a lot more apprenticeship from barbers than we are lawyers. I don't have any problem with this at all.
Hey, while we've got you on the air, just a quick question. One of your colleagues on the other side of the legislature, the assembly, Scott Souter, leaving his position there as a majority leader. Any thoughts on his transition into the Walker administration and his career? He's been at this for a while.
He's been at this for a while. And, you know, it's very time consuming being a legislator. I mean, not only do you have the stuff going on in Madison, but you're expected to show up a lot of stuff in the district. And somebody like Scott Souter is a good friend of mine. I mean, he represented a very large county, Clark County, a very spread out county, means a lot of travel, means showing up at a lot of events in your district. And being the majority leader down here in the state assembly was also highly demanding. So I think he probably accomplished almost all he wanted to do as a state assemblyman, and I'm sure he's going to do a good job in the Public Service Commission.
All right, Senator Grothman, thanks a lot for joining us today, and we'll keep track of that barber bill.
I always love that, and hopefully we're going to see within a few years, what do we call those type of things they have out in front, those things that go round and round?
Yeah,
and
those
round?
Spinny things, the blue, white, red things. I call them barber poles, right? Yeah.
Barber poles, that's it. Hopefully because of this bill, we hope 2 or 3 years from now, you will see a replenishing of barber poles throughout the state of Wisconsin. That's our goal.
All right. Senator Grothman, thanks a lot for joining us. Appreciate it.
Glad to be on the show.
That was State Senator Glenn Grothman, Republican from West Bend. Want to hear from you if you are in the barber trade, the cosmetology trade, or maybe you are learning to do one of those things. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page. Talk about what kind of training you have to go through, and if you're looking to just cut some hair, do you think the senator's right that it's too much of a burden to go through all that other training as well? That's the Central Time Facebook page. Go over and check it out.
Rob, I can't believe you just told Senator Grothman that you keep your hair, quote, kind of long, when in point of fact, you've been mistaken for Legolas the elf from behind.
It's a bit on the long side.
That's the understatement of the week, although it's a little shorter than usual now.
Right. One of my cuts was just in the last month.
You need to get more cuts to help out the barbers of Wisconsin.
That's true. To support the industry. I do.
Go
I do.
Shorter.
I try to tip well because I don't go very often. So I do that for them.
You make up for it. All right. Well, coming up next, a parent takes us through her journey raising a gender creative child. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.